This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer.
But welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today's guest is Matthew Vollmer. Matthew Vollmer is the author of two short story collections, Future Missionaries of America and Gateway to Paradise, as well as three collections of essays, Inscriptions for Headstones, Permanent Exhibit, and This World is Not Your Home, Essays, Stories, and Reports. He was the editor of A Book of Uncommon Prayer, which collects invocations from over 60 acclaimed and emerging authors, and served as co-editor of Fakes, an anthology of pseudo-interviews, faux lectures, quasi-letters, found texts, and other fraudulent artifacts. His work has appeared in venues such as Paris Review, Glimmer Train, Plowshares, Tin House, Oxford American, The Sun, the Pushcart Prize Anthology, and Best American Essays. He teaches in the MFA program at Virginia Tech, where he is a professor of English. His next book, All of Us Together in the End, will be published by Hub City Press in April. This family memoir begins with the death of his mother from early onset Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Soon after, flashing lights and floating orbs appear in the woods surrounding his family's home in rural North Carolina, where his widowed father lives. Formative memories of having been raised in the Seventh-day Adventist Church resurge in Vollmer's mind, hastening self-reexamination and reckoning. Welcome, Matthew.
Welcome.
Thank you.
We're so excited to have you. I really, really, really loved your book.
I'm glad that means a lot.
I tore through it. My father lives in Brevard, or actually outside of Brevard.
Oh, really?
In a community called Conestee Falls. Yeah. So also in Western North Carolina, on a mountain. And I called him and immediately was like, have you seen lights? tell me if you've seen lights. And he was like, no, I really haven't. He asked me if I knew about the blue ghost fireflies, which I'm sure you've heard of or even seen.
Yeah.
I said, no, I don't think it's that, but you know, do you open your window at night? And he was like, no, but now he's very interested. And you know, maybe he'll start seeing the lights.
Well, yeah, I mean, they, you know, in the book, one of the first things I did was put, North Carolina ghost lights into, Amazon to see if there were any kind of books that were like, and that's the literal title that popped up, North Carolina. Oh, wow. Sites.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it is very strange.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And, my dad and my mom met at BYU. So he's also of the sort of religion of absolutes, you know?
Oh yeah.
And, but is no longer Mormon. And is someone I think of as who's often questing and journeying to learn more about himself and about the universe. And so it reminded me again of your book, sort of this, you know, the absolutes and the mystery playing off each other throughout.
Right.
Will you read to us a little bit?
Sure. I'll read from the first few pages. On January 2020, the first case of coronavirus was detected in the United States. On this day, however, the word coronavirus was not trending on Twitter. Neither was COVID-19 or quarantine or pandemic. What terms were trending? Curb Your Enthusiasm and Venus Williams and Warren and Klobuchar and Australian Open and Hawaii shooting and Liverpool versus Man United and Jennifer Aniston. The words coronavirus and or COVID-19 did not appear on the front page of the New York Times, which instead offered stories about an Angolan interpreter who had built a shell empire, a story about the phenomenon of vanishing Native American women, and the president's impeachment trial. Very few people in the United States, it seemed, were talking about the virus. Nobody I knew had been. Neither had I. When I hadn't been designing assignments for my spring graduate course, or trying to write a read, or riding my bike, or planning my family's evening meals, I've been talking to anybody who would listen about the lights that had been appearing after dark in the woods where my father lived, a stone's throw from our family cemetery, on 100 acres of wilderness bordering national forest in the mountains of Western North Carolina. Nobody knew what to make of them. 1 month before, on December 21, 2019, the longest night of the year, I was taking a post-sunset walk following an asphalt trail that meandered through the nearby municipal golf course adjacent to my neighborhood toward the top of a hill that happened to be the highest point in the town of Blacksburg, Virginia, a spot that allowed visitors to view during daylight hours the icons of our little town, the football stadium, the turret of the colossal administration building, the coal plant, the futuristic-looking art center, and distant mountain ridges. My wife and son also enjoyed this view, but I usually took these walks alone to clear my head after a long day of teaching and reading and writing, or simply to get some fresh air. Hours earlier, I had attended a Virginia Tech basketball game with my friend Robert and his 13-year-old son Felix, the latter of whom had floated an idea he'd heard a YouTuber endorse, that as the Mayans had predicted, the universe had ended in 2012. We were now living in a simulation, which explained why everything these days seems so messed up. Admittedly, this was an intriguing theory to consider as I walked through the longest night of the year, which so far happened to be moonless. A smattering of stars appeared in the sky, clotted here and there with tufts of cloud drifting low enough to reflect the pinkish lights of the town center and the Virginia Tech campus. So convincing, I thought to myself. I meant the reality of it all, like what I was seeing. It all seemed so believable. As had become my habit on these random walks of mine, I decided to call my father. For the previous 3 months since my mother had died, he'd been living by himself on a remote piece of property in the mountains of southwestern North Carolina in the brick house that he and mom had moved into when I was 16. I'd often imagined, though he'd claimed this was not the case, that he might be lonely. "Hello," he said. "Hey," I said. "What am I interrupting?" That was his line, the one he used whenever he called me. "Well," he replied, "I've been meaning to tell you. Some weird stuff's been happening."
Matthew, I wanted to start with a question about structure. I was so interested at the places in the book where the lights and your own search for understanding related to the lights tied in with your father's would reappear, and how the rest of the meat of the book existed in between. And I was wondering if it was difficult for you while drafting to determine how much of that material, the lights material, was to make its way into the manuscript, and how much of the rest of the book should be there, that kind of balancing act you're doing throughout the book.
Well, so what was interesting is that I had been attempting to, and I just saw, God damn it, the Duke beat North Carolina.
Oh, I'm sorry. I know that's hard.
It's okay. Whatever. We've got next year. No, but I had been trying to write a memoir of my time in the Adventist church and in my Adventist family, for some years, for many years. And I had literally delivered a version of that book to my agent a few days before my mom died.
Whoa.
And he, I feel like one of the first things he said was like, nobody wants to read a memoir about grief or something. And I was like, well, isn't that what most of literature is?
Yeah. Also those memoirs do really well, I feel.
Right. Well, I mean, whatever. I don't want to throw him under the bus because I actually do love my agent a lot, and he's been great and very helpful. But the time, like, I was after she died, I knew she was going to die, but I didn't know how I was going to. I didn't know how I was going to feel after she died. I didn't know what was going to, and I certainly didn't know that there was going to be this weird like phenomenon that I'd have to deal with, and that was drawing me and my father closer in the initial stages of this. So I had already written a lot of stuff about like growing up Adventist, mm-hmm. and I was kind of pilfering it as I was, you know, writing this other thing. But once the lights showed up, it was a completely different book, completely differently structured, because, you know, the unknown became the central part. And there is this quote in the beginning of the book from Karen Armstrong's The Case for God, where she cites the scientist Karl Popper that says the most profound thing that we can say as human beings is that we know nothing. And as someone who had been raised to know everything,
mm-hmm.
and to have an answer for everything, you know, a quote like that is very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Because it releases you from, I mean, if you have to know everything, you're in a prison of mm-hmm. knowing everything. And if you can be released from that prison and say that I don't have to know anything, it is incredibly freeing. And that is what happened as I was researching and writing this book. But even before you know, my mother died, and I mean, that spirit was very present in me in terms of like being able to release what I could know for sure.
So your agent says to you, thank you, but not this book. And what do you do? You know, like what are the actions that you take with that manuscript at that point?
Well, I don't know that he said, I don't know if that's, I mean, it's that was the feeling that I got, but right. It was also like, it was a very, you know, it came at the time of her death.
Right.
And so, I was also, at the same time, it just happened to be teaching an overload, and my teaching and what I was doing in my classes, I felt were very informed by what, strangely enough, by my mother, because I was saying yes to people. I was being less critical. I found that I was opening up avenues for students to do things that I maybe normally would have said no to. I can't explain it other than to say that my mom died and I became more of my mom than before she was alive. I mean, I really believe that. And I was teaching a creative nonfiction course, and I shared with them I had written my mom's eulogy before she had died because I knew she was going to die. You know, I mean, you know, that's, and as a writer, I don't know if you guys are the same way, but if people in your family know that you're a writer, they will call upon you to write eulogies. And I've written many of them. But I wanted to write my mom's eulogy, and I had written it before she died, months before, but I didn't know until she died. And I went to my parents' house, and I was in the downstairs living room where my father was snoring beside my mom's dead body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That I could write something that was completely different than I'd expected. And it just came pouring out. And yeah, that's again, I've forgotten the question, because it's so easy to get lost in time when you're thinking about these things, because they're, you know, they're your parents, and mm-hmm. and you don't know when they're gonna pass, and you don't know what you're gonna say about them until they actually have passed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I thought I knew what I was going to say about my mom for months before she died. And then when she actually died, it was totally different, because I was in a house where my father was sleeping beside her dead body mm-hmm. for the last time.
That's one of the most touching parts of the book, is when he says, well, I suppose I'm going to sleep where I've been sleeping for the past 50 something years.
Yeah, exactly.
Next to my wife.
Had you written about your family extensively before? This is the first of your books that I've read, Matthew, and you have such a gift for seeing your family. I loved reading about your family. I would read more about your family. I was just wondering if this was the first time you had spent time doing that.
Well, I used to, in the beginning, I used to do it, in a way that was disguised.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of my fiction stories were probably somehow related to my family. And you know, when I discovered creative nonfiction, I always thought of myself as a fiction writer, because when I went to college and I first read Flannery O'Connor and other writers that seemed to be writing about the place where I was from, I was like, oh my gosh, like, wow, like these people are seeing the people that I know, and I can write about these people too. But I have written about my family in every instance mm-hmm. of my books, and that has had various consequences, and as anyone who reads all of us together in the end understands, you know, that title comes from my mom,
mm-hmm.
I don't know that she ever read anything. She probably just heard that I'd read something, and when I called her to talk about it, she was like, well, I just want us all to be together in the end, which means I want us all to be together in heaven, and for you not to have done something bad it would prevent you from going there. Which was, you know, painful to hear, but also understandable for someone who had grown up in the denomination that she had and that I had.
I feel like our families are not the right readers for our work.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It's painful for them.
Yeah, I mean the book before this one, which was a collection of essays and non-fictional stories, you know, my dad took we had a long discussion about why he didn't like it and why he was he didn't want people to read it, or maybe not.
Oh my
gosh. Maybe that wasn't it, but he was uncomfortable with it. And during the same weekend, his brother, who's older than him and who is actually a pastor, called me and put me on speakerphone with him to say how much he appreciated my honesty in writing the book, which I found was really interesting, because he had also been an English major at the same Adventist school that I had been in for a year and a half. And, you know, everybody has different reactions. And I mean, you know, if I suppose if my son were to write, a biography of his time with me, I would probably find things to argue with, but
totally.
But then again, my dad's not a reader, you know, and my uncle is, and there's differences within that.
Does anything ever feel off limits to write? And do you do it anyway?
That's a great question. I mean, I feel like a lot of this book was off limits, and I did it anyway.
What is that choice like for you? I feel like I think that's something that people struggle with, is I really want to write about this thing, but it's gonna hurt or upset people in my life. You know, like what is that? What do you ultimately decide that helps you continue writing it?
Well, I always think about whether it's a story that needs to be told, and if it needs to be told, however painful, could it help someone else to tell the story that they need to be told, right? Like, I could shrink like a, you know, and not tell what I needed to tell. But also I felt like it was my duty to my mother to tell what had happened to her, and to also make peace with what had happened to her. And I mean, it's never easy, and mm-hmm. it's never, I don't think it's ever the right or wrong thing. Like, if someone told me like, you shouldn't have written this book and you did the wrong thing, I could probably see their point, you know? But at on the other end of the spectrum, it's like, I've already heard from people who were saying like, this is amazing, and I'm so glad that you wrote this, because this allowed me to, you know, confront things about my own lost loved ones that, you know, that I hadn't been able to do. So, you know, it's I think writing is, being a writer is fucked up. I mean, let's just acknowledge it. I mean, it's, you have to deal with things that are not right, and you also are going to do things that are messed up, and you have to be able to acknowledge that, but also you have to be able to expect that taking those risks are going to, you know, be a way to connect with readers and people who have experienced similar things. I mean, as a teacher, I mean, I feel like I've been getting better over the years as a teacher of creative writing. And the weird thing is, I feel like I'm also like a group therapist. And people will, in my classes, will talk about that, you know, before I even say it, you know. It's, and I think that that's probably good and also fucked up. I mean, it's like it's a weird thing, right? Like, hey, come into this class where you can like, where I'm going to, you know, have you share about all your weird things that you've been experiencing, but also, you know, 90% of the time that's, I feel like that's healthy for people to do, you know, they, human beings need to tell their stories to each other. And they need to tell them in all the fucked up, weird, ugly ways that they can. And they need to feel like they can do that as weird as it is. And, I've tried to engineer my courses in such a way that, that allows for that to happen.
Was it difficult to begin working on another project after completing all of us together in the end, or was it freeing to complete the manuscript, go through editing and tell this very personal story to get it off your chest in a way? Did it feel freeing, or was it the kind of thing where it kind of stopped you for a little bit in your writing?
Well, that's a great question, because I feel like this was the culmination of I'm a fiction writer, but now I'm a nonfiction writer. And this is the culmination of my nonfiction writing period. The thing that I'm always trying to find the thing that will be transgressive, or that will be the thing that I would do that I didn't want to do. And I'll like try to force myself to do it as a writer. And, you know, after this, the thing that I thought about was to try to write a novel, because I have written two novels previously that were not picked up by anyone. And I had to deal with, I mean, those were like years long endeavors. And once I kind of opened up to nonfiction, I was like, oh, this is my jam. I'm going to do nonfiction, you know, like whatever. And I'm going to experiment with forms. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then I came like after this book, I was like, well, maybe the most radical thing I could do would be to write a traditional novel. a page turning novel. Could I do that? I mean, as a writer, am I allowed to do that? You know, it's been so fun to attempt to do that, especially with the like the content that I'm doing it with, which is, you know, a Seventh Day Adventist boarding school, which I've tried to do before. But yeah, I think like I'm always looking for something that's gonna surprise me. And weirdly, right now, the most traditional thing I could think to do, which is to write a fictional novel. I guess that's, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm doing.
You rebel. Awesome.
I know.
It's so punk rock.
Yeah.
I mean, putting it like, I'm going to write a page turner traditional, like just a normal ass novel. It does feel subversive in a way, right? Because I feel like literary type people are trying to go in different directions sometimes. So I don't know.
I just taught, Gary L. Lutz's The Sentence is a Lonely Place, which, you know, I'm sure has been taught, is being taught constantly in the MFA programs. But there's something about what she says about being a, like, trying to write a story that is a page turner and a page holder, or a page, mm-hmm. right? Like something that you want to get past, but also wants what you want to linger on. That's mm-hmm. what I want to do. Mm-hmm. I want to make something that is, you want to find out what happens, but you also want to linger. You want to go back and linger on the sentences. You want to go back and linger on what has been said about, you know, what the story, and you want to reread the story. You want to re-experience it.
That shit is hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is hugely hard to do. But you know, at this point in my career, I'm down to clown.
Hey. Down to clown, Matthew Vollmer, watch out. You know what felt like new to me and kind of subversive to me was this is the first pandemic memoir that I've read. You know, and like Alex and I have been doing this podcast since the pandemic started, basically, like the fall of the pandemic. Yeah. And that, you know, we've talked to lots of writers who've said, you know, like, I don't feel like I can write about that yet, or I don't feel like there's a market for it, or I don't feel allowed to write about that. Did any of that come up for you when you were, you know, shaping this book?
I totally embraced it because it was, it just happened to be in my wheelhouse. You know, like I had come off, you know, despite the fact that I had published a book that was, the year before this one, it was a collection of essays. The previous book was a collection of lyric essays, mm-hmm. which I was continuing to write lyric essays and publish them. And, you know, there was... To be alive in 2020 was to experience a never-ending collage of material and experiences. And so I was just constantly writing, you know, I kept a quarantine diary mm-hmm. where I was, you know, trying to record all of the things that I saw, whether it was in life on a walk, listening to Alan Watts, or, you know, looking at something on TikTok, or, you know, whatever it was, I was really paying it. It made me pay attention because I knew that this was a weird thing we were going through. And I was paying attention to my own weird things where I was wiping down my groceries.
Mm-hmm. Remember that? Oh,
I mean, we didn't fucking know anything
nope.
that was going on. And so I thought that was, you know, as a writer, I thought, well, that's something I should be taking stock of. But it was also interrupting my story that I wanted to follow about my dad in the lights and my mom in the lights and whatever. It turned out that it was part of that. I'm always interested in collage, and I'm always interested in like fragments. And, so like asking, you know, like interviewing people who I thought would be interested in the light situation, or that had experienced, you know, some sort of, you know, after like Cherry on the book, like her mom had died and she thought that she experienced her after she died. Mm-hmm. I was like, I want to know about that. You know, I want to hear about it. And trying to put all those things together and make sense of them or make nonsense of them, you know, was really important to me.
I was a little bit surprised how how much the pandemic material just felt completely normal to read. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was not jarring at all to read. And
but there was a time when it would have felt that way, right? Like there was a time when maybe we were still too in the thick of it, right? Where
I don't know.
Didn't know how it was going to turn out or something.
Sure. Yeah. I honestly don't know, Lindsay. I mean, I think the only other book that we've done on the show that like directly dealt with it was that Lee Stein mm-hmm. collection. But for that poetry, was a really different project. I don't know. It felt to me like, it just fit. It worked. I think a lot of the anxiety that has been discussed by so many writers on the show and elsewhere is just about, you know, including pandemic material or if it is too soon. I think a lot of it's kind of ridiculous. It's like, I mean, yeah, we lived through it. It happened. I mean, Jesus Christ, what else do we have? It happened.
Yeah, it's starting to pop up. So, I mean, Rebecca Mackay's new novel, it's in there, but it's not even, it's just sort of like, it, you know, and COVID was happening, so we had masks on, and, you know, then the rest of the book goes on.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
But it was also like, it was also so fucking weird, right? Like,
oh yeah.
There's so many weird idiosyncratic details that come out of people's, you know, experience of it and dealing with it. And I just felt like I had to include that because like everything in my life was totally fucked up and weird. You know, my mom died who shouldn't have died. And my dad was, I mean, it was just like a series of like unbelievable situations that were happening and I had to record them. And I was like, just trying to make sense of them. And all the other people in my family were the same way, but I was the person who could actually write it down, you know? So from doing the eulogy, which was probably one, like reading my mom's eulogy to the people who were at the memorial was probably one of the most powerful writerly things I've ever done in my life.
Wow.
I mean, just to be like, this is who my mom was, and I can say this because I have the words to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like, I'm in charge of how you understand who my mom was, who was like one of the most magical people I've ever known. Like, mm-hmm. it was so powerful. And it was, you know, I don't know.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Has your dad seen the lights since the last thing that you
told us? That is such a great question. I'm glad you asked that. You know, there's an epilogue where at the end of the book where he and Jolene both see the lights, but they have since, and well, I will say they, but it's, I have to imagine it's mostly Jolene. They have set up these LED lights that project onto the trees outside their house at night. So you can't actually look into the dark anymore.
Oh my gosh.
If you were at their house and you were looking outside at night, you will see a bazillion lights that are projected by these LED lights. And my dad will say, well, at least there's no more whippoorwills.
Oh my God.
Because, you know,
he didn't like the whippoorwills.
I don't know if you've ever had to listen to them, but they make you go insane. And that is the only thing that I will say that is positive about the situation.
So did they do that so that there would be no more lights?
You tell me.
That is such a sicko move. I mean, that is just like, that is so fucking sad and hilarious. Just Amazing.
Well, now
I love
like
it.
Mimi
I mean,
is probably
honestly,
like, now I
honestly,
see the
I, it is. I mean, it's hyper perplexing in terms of my father, but he has done a number of things, you know, that I don't understand, and that I couldn't understand unless I've lost my own spouse and
sure.
marry and give them whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I would say that, that has been one of the most perplexing parts of this situation. But, I mean, if you read the book, you realize that like the lights are more scary to my dad than they are to me.
Right.
Right.
He believes they're evil, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, he has, I don't know if that's his final, if that's his final Jeopardy, you know, answer, but he definitely did at some point. He was like, you know, I don't like this, right? This bothers me.
Right.
Whereas I, when I saw them, I was quite, I don't know. I liked it. I loved it. I thought it was
wonderful. I mean, you shared them with everyone. You shared them with everyone in the book, and you wrote the book. I mean,
right.
you were bringing, yeah. I mean, you brought them to so many people, so many readers as well. I mean, it's kind of amazing the difference in responses.
Well, I mean, when you're locked into, I you know, it at one point I say in the book, like, you know, my dad and I are waiting to see the lights. From the, we turn all the lights out in the house and we're looking out of the bedroom or the living room windows, and we're waiting to see them. And it's the first time that I've ever been with my father in a situation where he didn't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Or he would have admitted to that, right? Like, I had grown up in a denomination, where we had answers for everything. There was nothing that we didn't have an answer for. And to be standing with him at the precipice of unknowing was one of the most exciting things that I've ever experienced, because, wow. You know, it was like me and my dad were in the same place, you know, like mm-hmm. we both miss my mom, and we were sitting there watching whatever would happen. And he hadn't at that time told me that, you know, that he was scared of it or whatever. It was us as a family standing at that edge and acknowledging that we didn't know what was going to happen. And it was so, I mean, that's a weird thing to say, right? Like to acknowledge that not knowing would be something that could be comforting. But if you come from a situation like that, that's how you know.
I have to ask you, because you mentioned this in your acknowledgments. You mentioned Lee Klein.
Oh yeah,
and he came up with a title that you didn't use.
Yeah,
what was it?
It was The Meaning of Light.
Oh, that's so good.
It is good, and I do use it as a section title.
That's true, yes.
But I felt like I needed to use my mom's, my mom's quote, because that is what it's been before even it was this version of things. Like it was that just haunted me more than anything. Yeah, partly because, you know, my mom was always a happy, delightful person, and one of the only times that I'd heard her cry was when she thought that, you know, because I wasn't going to be a person in her church, that I would also be not in heaven with her.
Right.
And that was what she was most, you know, occupied by.
But now you've given it to her. in the form of this book.
Yes, yes.
Matthew, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
We did it.
Yes, we did.
Britt recorded me snoring a few nights ago and played it for me.
Oh,
it was horrifying.
Oh, yeah.
And then after she played it, and I said something similar. I think I said the word horrifying. She said,
"Snorifying."
No. She goes, "That's not even close to the worst of it."
Oh no! Oh my gosh!
Oh yeah, great.
Yeah, Ben snores, but I don't even think he snores that loud. I think I just like I'm too light of a sleeper after having three children, you know, like you're always listening for them.
Right.
So like it's not even that he snores that loud, but one thing he does is that his feet flutter. I don't know what's going on. It's like his little feet are down there going like and it like moves the whole bed, and his feet don't do that in waking life.
What about when he's flying?
I know. It's like we watched Black Panther 2, and like one of the characters has wings on his feet.
Okay.
And when he flies with his feet wings, they just go like bip, 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 bip. And that's what Ben's feet do.
Oh man.
So I'd be like, honey, you're doing the feet thing. Anyway, it's hard out here, okay?
Yeah, it is.
I saw women talking today.
Oh, cool.
And Ben goes, "Oh, I'm going to go see men punching." But it was really hard not to weep the whole time. And I've read the book, but I guess I had put some of that out of my mind. Anyway, it was excellent. It was so good. It was exactly as I pictured it.
Wow.
And I had a hard time conceiving how you could make that book into a movie, but
yeah,
they did it.
That's funny.
It's wonderful.
I'm rereading Miriam Tay's right now.
Which one?
All My Puny Sorrows.
Oh, come on.
Oh my God. What
amazing.
A book. Holy shit.
Did you see that her daughter's a writer too?
I actually didn't. No.
Yeah. Chelsea Beaker interviewed Miriam Tay's at the Portland event for, I guess, her paperback for Fight Night.
Uh-huh.
And then Miriam sent her daughter's book.
Whoa.
I know. And the other thing is I'm reading Age of Vice and it's excellent. That's it.
That's awesome. I'm reading Topeka School as well.
Oh, I've never read that. No, the Ben Lerner book?
Yeah, I'd never read Ben Lerner. And I'm really enjoying it so far. I don't know what I expected, but it's not what I expected.
Yeah, I've never read him either.
It's it's kind of incredible so far.
You can read two books at once.
I kind of prefer to do that. Yeah.
Really?
But I'm rereading All My Puny Sorrows. So it's that's just like, you know,
revisiting.
Like, it's like the purest pleasure, you know, like just like go back, reread something like that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, don't you for the show and stuff? Aren't you always reading? You're not reading more than one book at a time?
No, I read them like I read one and then when I'm done with that, I read the next one.
But I'm not nearly as good as you at, I will abandon books for any reason. Like I'll just stop at some point. I have no problem just stopping reading a book. So.
I've gotten better at that, but I recently read some book. I'm glad I can't remember the title because I shouldn't even say it. And I made it like three quarters of the way through.
And bailed.
Like, pretty much hating it the whole time and thinking like, but this is good for me. You know, like I see that this is like a different thing and it's good for me to read and like it's interesting in that way. And I finally I was like, fuck this.
Did you actually have that? Did you actually have those thoughts? Like this is like edifying?
Well, yeah, it had come, I think I remember it being recommended by someone I respect. And so I was like trying to see it from that, from their eyes or from their like brilliance. And
God, I wish I knew, I wish you remembered what it was. Lindsay, have a great week.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
Bye, bud. See ya.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yeah, yeah.